It's about 15 seconds after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Today's Monday, the 19th of June, 2017. This is a Juno afternoon. We have several great guests today. Chris Peterson to talk about his new business, Peterson's Pretzels. Bill Merck will be here to give us details about the Summer Poetry Showcase. Ishmael Hope and Scott Burton will be here to highlight a new production on Clinkett art and lineage. And we're going to get some details about the continuing cleanup of Project Playground. And Don Habiger will also be here with details about Wednesday's community discussion about reentry issues. So stay tuned for a busy Monday Juno afternoon following National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The commissioners of Nebraska's Sheridan County have approved the opening of a Family Dollar store in the village of White Clay. The small Pine Ridge Reservation border town has long been known for the sale of alcohol, but recently the four beer stores located there lost their licenses. Jim Kent reports.
Among the plans for a new White Clay discussed during the recent meeting of the governor's White Clay task force was the opening of a Family Dollar store. Lauren Paul is one of the Sheridan County commissioners who approved the proposal.
Sheridan County is zoned agriculture unless otherwise stated. Because White Clay is an unincorporated village, then they have no zoning of their own, so it fell within the county's zoning plan.
Although he takes a neutral stand on the plan, Lauren Paul feels there was more of an economic opportunity for the White Clay community with the liquor stores, especially regarding employment opportunities.
And why I say that is Family Dollar, being a national corporation, any profits that they generate within their system will not be spent in White Clay or in Sheridan County. They'll be taken to their corporate headquarters, wherever that's at.
But Ivan Sorbel sees the situation differently. The executive director of the Pine Ridge Area Chamber of Commerce considers the opening of a Family Dollar store in White Clay as a positive for the national franchise, as well as for the 40,000 Lakota people who live literally just next door.
The availability of more products for the residents of Pine Ridge will assist them in finding the goods that they need, such as clothing and healthcare items.
Sorbel adds that it's nice to see steps being taken toward White Clay becoming a town that can provide goods and services for a large cross-section of Pine Ridge residents, not just those who purchase alcohol. I'm Jim Kent.
A bill to allow public meetings to be held on Indian lands headed to Oregon's governor last week, as correspondent Emily Schwing tells us.
Back in 2014, Oregon's Board of Forestry tried to hold a public meeting at an Indian-owned casino near Coos Bay. The meeting was allowed, but the department could not make any official decisions or deliberate. House Majority Leader Jennifer Williamson of Portland says Senate Bill 317 changes that.
This bill clarifies existing state law to allow meetings at the numerous tribal facilities throughout the state.
There are 9 federally recognized Indian tribes in Oregon. Chuck Sams, a spokesman for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, calls it a housekeeping measure for state departments and agencies. He says it won't affect tribal law regarding meetings held by those sovereign governments. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Construction of a state highway and bridge in Duluth, Minnesota was recently halted after human remains were found. More from Dan Huckelack.
The Minnesota Department of Transportation stopped construction of the Highway 23 project after the discovery of human remains. It is not yet clear whether the remains are Native American, but historical maps show that Ojibwe burial grounds existed in Duluth's Fond du Lac neighborhood. The site is located approximately 10 miles down the St. Louis River from the current Fond du Lac reservation, but it was part of the band's homeland long before statehood in 1858. According to Fond du Lac Vice Chairman Bruce Savage, the disturbance of the burial site and subsequent construction delay could have been avoided.
I don't know if it will ever be 100% preventable, but this one could have been. There was no government-to-government consultation on this project. If they would have thought outside of their scope of work and contacted us, someone within our organization would have gladly made them aware of the high-sensitive area.
Fond du Lac conservation officers are securing the area 24 hours a day until MnDOT receives approval to resume construction. MnDOT also hired a private security firm to ensure that no remains or artifacts are removed. I'm Dan Huckelack.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
The third National Gathering of American Indian Veterans takes place July 21st through the 23rd in Wheaton, Illinois, with World War II code talkers and Native bands and dancers. Information at TricksterGallery.com. Proud to support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And it's just about 6 minutes after the hour. Today's Monday, the 19th of June. I'm Ben Brown. This is A Juno Afternoon. And with me here in the studio is Chris Peterson. Welcome to A Juno Afternoon, Chris.
Thank you very much, Ben.
And you are the co-owner, I believe, with your wife of Peterson's Pretzels.
Absolutely. My wife and I, Carol, own Peterson's Pretzels, and we run it out there by Costco. As you may have seen, we also have, of course, a couple of pretzel carts downtown, which we have some great kids working for us, manning those pretzel carts to serve pretzels to both the tourists and locals alike.
And what brought you to the world of being a pretzel maker?
Well, a couple years ago, our daughter was in need of a job, and so we decided we were trying to search for something. We really wanted to offer visitors to Juneau something. You know, we weren't really sure what it was going to be. We had our eye, and we were thinking about some clam chowder, some sort of seafood-themed product. And after reading an article in the Juneau Empire about another restaurateur in Juneau who tried that, and he is currently very successful, he tried that, and it wasn't successful. So I said, let's scratch that. Let's try something else. And so my wife came up with the idea of soft pretzels. And I thought she meant just the kind of pretzels you get at Costco, and we would just sell them downtown. And I thought, I kind of poo-pooed that idea. It's like, I don't think that's going to work, hon. So I think one evening, last couple falls ago, we were just sitting around, and we said, hey, let's that's soft pretzels. Why don't we look up some recipes and just make some? And so we made some pretzels, and darn, they were good. And personally, I'd actually never had a freshly baked pretzel, and so we tweaked some recipes, and we started adding some flavors to them, and thought, geez, these things are really good. And so we launched Peterson's Pretzels.
And it obviously is doing well if you've got multiple locations. And so the pretzel business, I mean, that's the main thing on the menu. I know they're often served with cheese and with mustard. Are those condiments that are a part of what you have going on?
They are. They are indeed. We of course, serve ours with a spicy cheese sauce that we, of course, buy commercially. But also, we make our own salted caramel. Folks really rave about that. That goes great with our traditional one, our cinnamon sugar pretzel. We also make an herbed olive oil. So we mix a bunch of herbs in with the olive oil and offer our customers the opportunity to use balsamic vinegar with that. So that goes great with our Italian Parmesan pretzel. So as far as the pretzel business is concerned, I know that this is back east, in Pennsylvania, that's a really big pretzel area. Folks who come from the east and come to Alaska and come to Juneau try pretzels, they typically don't even want anything with the pretzel, or they just want mustard. But we offer, as you mentioned, a variety of sauces, and we also just added a freshly made marinara sauce as well.
Excellent, excellent. Now, and do all the pretzels come with salt on them, or is salt optional?
Salt is optional. If you get to our trailer when we're making the pretzels and you wish to have no salt, we'll certainly accommodate that request, absolutely. Even no egg. We just had a young lady come and ask for no egg, so we made a pretzel with no egg. We'll definitely offer people a special request if they wish, some special recipe, whatever the case may be.
Well, my blood pressure is a little high, so I try to cut out the extraneous salt. I think it tastes really delicious. And, of course, you mentioned the no egg. But I have to ask this. I love gluten. I think it's delicious. No, I really don't even know what it is. But, I mean, is gluten-free an option as well?
You know, it's not.
Okay, not yet.
Not with us.
Okay.
We purchase some gluten-free flour, and we just – couldn't make a pretzel.
And there's some things that, you know, they just have to have gluten in them. So right. I thought I would just ask, because that seems to be a very big thing on most people's agendas these days.
Absolutely. We are cognizant of the health issues. All of our pretzels, of course, when folks order them for catering purposes, we let them know that, of course, you know, there's some people may have nut allergies, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So the pretzel salt that we were purchasing was actually produced in a place that processes nuts and that thing. So we need to let people know that. And the salt does come off fairly easily. So if someone is has to be concerned about the amount of salt they consume, then they can easily brush the salt off.
And it's not like an allergy. It's just the more salt goes in, the more the blood pressure can go up. So
right.
Absolutely. So as far as the business goes here in town, you mentioned the idea of chowder. You know, Tracy LaBarge is really successful with her crab bisque, but it takes a while to kind of build a loyal clientele for something like that. But it sounds like you are really discovering there are some pretzel lovers out there and you're developing a relationship with them.
Yeah, we are. We offer, of course, our customers initially it was called a loyal customer card, but now it's just basically a punch card. And so customers can get a punch card. And if for whatever reason they weren't offered the punch card, we'll certainly honor their, I bought a pretzel downtown and I didn't get a punch card. So we'll honor that and we'll give them a punch card. But they can get a free pretzel after 5 purchases. So a fairly quick response, I guess a quick reward for your
patronage. Yeah, nice
your
turnaround. Not,
nice
10,
turnaround.
Not 10, only 5.
And I've noticed that this is our third summer. And I've noticed the plastic bag of redeemed punch cards is growing larger and larger. This year by far is certainly the largest. So yes, we do have a pretty loyal following, and we haven't done any advertising, only through some social media means, but mostly word of mouth. And I think one of the great ways we accomplish that is that we offer pretzel platters through as a catering option, and so folks will take those platters to a gathering of some sort. So then all these people then of course are introduced to our pretzels, which is great. Of course, as you know, the best form of advertising is personal recommendation. So
absolutely. And so do you have an online presence? If people want to learn more about some of the catering opportunities, or do they need to give you a call, or how would they expand their knowledge?
Absolutely. Well, we do have websites, www.petersonspretzels.com. That's S-O-N. On there, we offer folks just kind of a little background about our company, when we started. We started a few years ago, as you mentioned, just for a job for our daughter. The catering options are there as well, as far as, that's through our online store with Square, basically. But, folks can order half a dozen, 18, 24, a pretzel platter, a pretzel bite platter. And I really apologize for not bringing you a freshly baked pretzel.
The more we talk about it, the more I probably would enjoy one right now, although I did have lunch already. But I would not be able to resist if it were here. And at some point, I will make it a point to stop by. I go to Costco all the time and just check out the trailer out there. And so probably a lot busier in the summer than in the winter, but there definitely is a year-round operation going on.
We're definitely, we're just moving into a year-round operation. Our first summer we had basically just the one pretzel cart, and we leased a church kitchen. That's how we started. The second summer we stayed in the same kitchen because we did not have our own commercial kitchen. And I built another pretzel cart, so we had 2 pretzel carts, and we were still leasing the same kitchen downtown. The beginning of this summer, or the end of last summer, excuse me, we purchased a 20-foot food trailer, which is now our commercial kitchen. And so that is where we produce all of our pretzels out of. That is, of course, over by Costco, right where Affordable Auto used to be. And, we have a sign out there, but I think a lot of folks, the sign was really meant to be a banner for our pretzel cart. And so we haven't gotten a really nicely produced sign yet, but we're getting there. And we started operating on that lot back in the fall, just on weekends, because I'm a full-time teacher. Also.
All right.
And so my wife and I both were working full time, and then she, she quit her job with the state back in December, I believe. And so we were just operating on that lot on the weekends. And the response was really great. And so I spoke with the owner of the property, and he agreed to lease that corner to us. And so we have begun basically 6 days a week now on that location, plus our 2 pretzel carts. And yes, summer times are definitely busier, obviously. But we do want to continue operating year round. And, we wish to expand our menu, for lunchtime customers who may want to have a pretzel, but we're thinking in terms of making some sort of a sandwich of some sort with a pretzel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not there yet, but we hope to be.
All right, that's exciting. Pretzel sandwiches, so stay tuned. Well, you've learned a lot, listeners, from Chris Peterson about Peterson's Pretzels this afternoon. Anything else you would like to share with our listeners on a Juneau afternoon?
No, I just encourage folks who would like to have and or have never tried a freshly baked pretzel to stop one by. A freshly baked pretzel is just absolutely delicious. Yes, you can get other pretzels in town for less of a price or more reasonable cost, but a truly delicious pretzel, freshly baked right out of the oven. Can't beat it.
Very good. Thank you so much, Chris Peterson, and best of luck with your continuing venture, Peterson's Pretzels.
Thank you.
It's about 19 minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juneau afternoon on Monday, the 19th of June. The weather forecast from the National Weather Service is for rain today, a high around 60, east winds to 15 miles per hour. This evening, numerous rain showers, a low around 15, southeast winds to 15 miles per hour. And rain showers for the rest of the week, more or less. Ishmael Hope and Scott Burton will be coming in just a moment. And now let's have a little bird note.
This is Bird Note. Think of a bird sitting on its eggs, keeping them warm, waiting for them to hatch. Sounds familiar, right? But not all birds do this. Some lay their eggs underground, in geothermally heated burrows, in warm sands, or even in huge mounds of organic material warmed by the heat of decomposition. These birds are called megapodes, or mound builders. and they look a bit like large chickens. There are about 20 different species, and they're found in Australia, New Guinea, and nearby islands. The male builds the mound, which may contain tons of organic matter. Periodically, he'll poke his beak in to check the temperature. Then he'll adjust the amount of material to maintain the heat at a constant high level. Deep below the surface are the eggs. They're larger than most and contain a higher proportion of yolk. After an unusually long incubation period, the eggs hatch and the chicks claw their way to the surface. They never know their parents. But the young megapodes are already fully feathered and capable of flying and feeding themselves. As always, you can see photos and videos. Begin at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Today's show is brought to you by White Flower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for early summer planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com.
A public service announcement. Next Monday, the 3rd of July, a week from today, a statue of William Seward will be dedicated in front of the state capitol downtown in the plaza near the Diamond Courthouse. This Monday evening, there will be a radio special with some guests who will talk about the U.S. Secretary of State and Governor of New York, who was integral to the purchase of Alaska from Tsarist Russia. And so that will be Monday, the 3rd of July at 7 p.m. during Focus on Community. It is about 23 minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown, and this is a Juno afternoon. And next, our guest this afternoon, my guests are Scott Burton and Ishmael Hope. So welcome, gentlemen, to a Juno afternoon.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Ben. Thanks for having us on the show.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm glad that you're here because I mentioned all these guests at the beginning, and they haven't all materialized, but there's still half an hour to go. So. But you guys are here, so what are we talking about? We're talking about Tlingit heritage and lineage.
Yes, it is called Lineage, Tlingit Art Across Generations. And it is a documentary that Scott and I have been working on, along with Cheryl Snyder and David Purdy. We've been working on for pretty much the last year. And we've been tracing these lineages and these continuities of Tlingit artists. I mean, I know there's a ton of really, really good Tlingit artists out there. There's a lot of great work. So I feel bad that we can't get everyone. But this particular tack is seeing how the spirit of Tlingit art continues. How people within families, within master to apprentice, teacher to student, how that kind of that life, that spirit regenerates itself.
That's very timely and important. You know, we've recently lost a couple of really wonderful Tlingit artists, Terry Rothkar and Clarissa Raisel, both passed away last year, relatively young.
Yeah.
But they also had pupils. And so Anna Ehlers Brown, I know, also is still working.
Yes.
So how were you able, knowing that there's this really large universe of artists out there, how were you able to go out and pick your subjects, knowing you had finite resources and time?
Yes, finite resources and time, that's a big one. I mean, really, it was a budget from the Alaska Humanities Forum. Excellent. It allowed us to make it happen. But with budget, that allowed us to mostly only film in Juneau and to choose one place that we could go to. And so we chose Sitka. And so you mentioned Terry Rothkar, Clarissa Raisel. She's my mother-in-law. So obviously that hits home. And they're both 60, so you're right, they're both young. And they amazingly and I think beautifully, we had an opportunity to spend time with the both of them. So they're very prominently shown in the film, which I'm so pleased with. Scott and I were just working on this because it's a continuous process with the film. It always ends up being a lot more than you think. And so we were just looking at this, and I just want to do it justice because there are these amazing artists out there, and they all have beautiful stories, and it adds an extra weight to it that we get to show these master weavers. And so really, you know, I just want us to not be in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Allow their voices, allow their spirits, allow their personalities and their stories to, in some way, just blossom.
And the hard part, I'm sure, I mean, Scott, you can talk about this because you're probably doing a lot of the hands-on editing work with Ishmael. You've probably gathered many, 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 many hours of footage. And how long is the final product that we're aiming to be?
It's going to be an hour documentary.
So you've got some serious editing on your hands.
It's true. It's true. And, you know, among the highlights of the film for me was sitting in Terry's studio with Ishmael and David Purdy. And David and I were just blown away. And maybe you were too, Ishmael. Mm-hmm. This was in the fall of last year, and she, you tell she was in pain, but she was in great space, and it was one of the most poignant interviews I've ever been a part of, and her and Ishmael communicated beautifully. She showed us more art than we ever could have hoped for and shared some really, really poignant thoughts that we are just honored to be able to share in this film.
Well, she really had a gift, not just of creating good art or being a good teacher, but being a good ambassador for the arts. When Jane Chu, the chairman of the NEA, was here a couple of years ago, we got to visit with her at her studio in Sitka.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane Chu's met thousands of artists across this country, and she's even met hundreds of indigenous artists. And she was particularly touched by Terry. And when I actually saw her in D.C. earlier this year, she was aware that Terry had passed away. So that really is a wonderful gift that you were able to be there at the time you were and when you were. As you continue the end, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I'm just going to say that we, as a documentary filmmaker, I mean, it's maybe too much to expect artists to be very expressive and alive and vibrant and all these things. And Terry, you know, and really I'd have to say all these artists that we interviewed, they were. They had this. They pop out on the screen to me, as at least I say. I know I'm a creator. You got to leave the audience to allow their own viewpoint to it. But I agree with you on how vibrant Terry was.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I can tell you from the perspective of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, on which I serve as chairman. You know, one of our grant categories is Master and Apprentice, and we do not get enough of applications in that area. And so I'm hopeful that something like the documentary you're working on will create some interest in young Tlingit or other Alaska Natives or even non-Indigenous Alaskans just to say, hey, there's some opportunities out here and maybe I should go find a master to teach me something.
Well, I think that's that. Just seeing exactly how Tlingit art is seen from someone that you might call a traditionalist perspective, like Paul Marx is someone we interviewed extensively. We went to Nora Dauenhauer's home. Clarissa Raisel, in her way, was a tradition bearer, as was Terry. Just to allow them to show how the art, from their perspective, comes alive and how they learned from their teachers. You know, I think that continuity is always, and it's always precarious, even when you're not dealing with colonization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always a precarious thing because, you know, that's paramount on that older generation to give the essentials to the next generation. And it's a beautiful thing to see when it's received. And those stories, in particular, I think we were initially interested in finding, and amazingly we did, through ceremonies, through the time we spent in their homes, through seeing the community, not just these one-on-one interviews, but seeing the community come to life.
Very good. So no pressure, but what's the timeline on this? When do you have to have this thing in the can? And then, Scott, what are the plans for broadcasting it or having some sort of a kickoff party to celebrate the work when it's done?
So good question. Actually, tomorrow we're going to be doing a director's cut screening at 6 o'clock downstairs at 360 here in the K2 building. Doors open at 5:30. Admission is free. We invite everyone who would like to see the director's cut of the film tomorrow to please come. And after the one-hour screening from 6 to 7, at 7 o'clock, we're going to pull up the screen and then invite artists from the show, from the movie. Nick Galanin's going to be there, Lily Hope, Paul Marks, Ricky Tagaban, Ishmael are going to be on stage to have a panel discussion about the film a bit. And how else would you describe the conversation?
I think it'll be a little bit about what's next. I think that's because you have a certain timeline in how you film some things. So we'll hear from the artists. We'll ask them some questions about where they're at with their current projects and how they envision Tlingit art always that question of continuity. How is this going to continue to regenerate?
Very good. So that's very timely. Then tomorrow the doors will open. You said at 5:30 for 6 o'clock screening, and then the panel discussion to follow about 7 o'clock.
Yep, and then final broadcast, and all of that happens in late August.
Excellent.
Yeah, and then the one-hour documentary and the panel will broadcast as companion pieces.
Oh, so the panel discussion tomorrow will be recorded as well.
Exactly.
Very good. And so, the Alaska Humanities Forum is, of course, the state of Alaska's affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Out of Anchorage, it's a nonprofit organization, and they do a lot of really good work. So this is very good that you were able to get a grant from them, but it probably didn't pay for the entire project budget.
Well, I think it needed a ton of support from KTOO. It needed support from the leadership. Cheryl, for example, has helped to free up a lot of Scott's time. And so I'd say there's a huge in-kind donation from KTOO, and that's very special. So, yeah, it didn't cover everything, but I think what it allowed us to do was to tell this story that I think a perspective from the Native people. Starting there, how we see the art, how we want to present the art, how we live in the art. I don't think there's really been anything like that out there. And I've been looking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want this kind of material. I research this stuff. And so it's very nice to actually just allow that to live and to breathe on screen.
Yeah, I can think of some publications, but I can't think of anything that was a film that's quite in this line of work. Anne Phoenix Reardon, I mean, books are different than a film, so this is going to be much more accessible, and it's great that you're going to be able to record the panel discussion tomorrow, because that will just give the entire thing a lot more depth and context and perpetuity as it's being watched by people.
Well, I think it's exciting for anyone that has interest in Northwest Coast art. It's this world-famous art, and it just happens to be in Alaska. There just hasn't been as much scholarship and resources thrown its way comparatively to British Columbia. So that's I think one reason why Tlingit art, as compared to maybe Haida and Kwakwaka'wakw, Tsimshian art, hasn't had as much attention received to it or resources given to it. And so this is a good chance to tell our story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, there's a different model for public support for arts and culture in Canada than there is in the United States. But we live where we live, and we're grateful for the resources that we have.
Exactly.
And you gentlemen are doing a fine job taking what there is and making it work. So I applaud you for that.
Exactly. I mean, the Alaska Humanities Forum and KTOO, support from organizations like Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, who has started Rosita World, her vision of making Juneau a capital of Northwest Coast art. I think this is a part of that continuity, part of that dialogue.
Do you think it'll be possible for it to be shown at the Walter Soboloff Center someday?
I'd love to. I think there's been a lot of people who wanted to, like in Teslin, they have this great celebration, Hakusti. They, you know, I've heard interest there, and just museums that have Northwest Coast collections, or who knows?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a dream, I think, is maybe it can get a nationwide audience. Like some other documentaries in this kind of format have gotten.
But know? At an hour in length, visitors might be able to see it, like at the Sheetka Kwan place in Sitka. I mean,
yeah.
So just, I'm sure, you know, you got to get the film done first.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you can figure out the distribution and marketing plan.
The distribution question is definitely...
You know, your Oscar campaign, all that can come later.
The distribution question is great. Just officially, though, is, as we're talking about, get it to a statewide audience, to go with a panel discussion, share that on a statewide audience in August, and then just continue that distribution question from there. But I'm just grateful, though, that there are these interests, the interests out there, and my answer is we're aiming for it.
Excellent. Well, really good to hear about this. And, of course, I really didn't know. I didn't know it had to do with Clarissa or Terry. I just mentioned them because I was aware of their recent passing. So, wow, it's serendipity that you guys have been working on this. I'm very grateful to learn about it, and I look forward to seeing it and learning more about it.
Thanks much. Thanks much.
Anything else, Scott? Okay, very good. Thank you, Ishmael Hope and Scott Burton. And it's called Clinkett Art and Lineage. And tomorrow night the screening is here. Doors open 5:30, 6 o'clock, and then there'll be a panel discussion afterwards. So it's supposed to rain, like I said a little while ago. Come and see a really great film here at KTOO. Thanks again.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 19th of June, 2017. It's the birthday of Pauline Kael, born Petaluma, California, 1919. Went off to Berkeley, tried her hand at filmmaking and playwriting. And then she started running an art film theater in Berkeley as she wrote reviews for various publications. She began writing for the New Yorker magazine, Movie Reviews, in 1968. Reviews collected in various books, including I Lost It at the Movies and When the Lights Go Down. It's the birthday of Tobias Wolff, Birmingham, Alabama, 1944. Author of the memoir This Boy's Life and his memoir Old School. His brother Jeffrey wrote memoirs as well, and their mother Rosemary once said, "If I'd known both my boys were going to be writers, I might have lived life a little differently." Tobias Wolff, who said about writing, "I have learned that you can be patient and diligent, and sometimes it just doesn't strike sparks. Writing well is not a promised reward for being virtuous. Every time you do it, you're stepping off into darkness and hoping for some light." Tobias Wolff said, "We love hearing stories of other people's misfortunes, not terrible misfortunes, but if somebody has taken a really expensive holiday, we don't mind hearing that their flight was canceled and they had to sleep on the airport floor and that there was no snow on the slopes when they finally arrived and that the heating crashed in their hotel and that they had to wear several layers of clothing to bed every night. We live by stories." It was on this day, 1964, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, which outlawed all segregation on the basis of race in the United States. The bill needed 67 votes in the Senate to break a Southern filibuster, and it got 71. And it's the birthday of the mathematician and mystic Blaise Pascal, born in Clermont, France, in 1623, who invented the first mechanical calculator, and also experienced a divine vision one November night in 1654, went off to live in a convent, wrote his Pensées, his thoughts, in which he describes his wager, arguing that if God does not exist, the skeptic loses nothing by believing in him, but if God does exist, then the skeptic gains salvation. Pascal also argued that it is the heart that experiences God, and not reason. Here's a poem for today by Greg Watson, a poem about a dog, Yellow Lab Outside the Coffee Shop. The yellow lab outside the coffee shop today cannot sit still, but instead radiates the ever-expectant energy of 1,000 hummingbirds, tail sweeping back and forth across the gray, littered sidewalk, sits without touching the ground, knowing that any moment the one who matters most will emerge, slip his worn leash from the bench, and the day will suddenly fall into place. Every sound, sight, and aroma discovered anew, the sun thrown everywhere at once with a cool lake of shadow following, as if it had somewhere to go. Greg Watson's poem, Yellow Lab, Outside the Coffee Shop, from When the Music Remains, published by Noden Press, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, from color copies to presentations to promotional products. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples. It's pro time. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's a little after 41 minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Today is Monday, the 19th of June. This is a Juno afternoon. And Mike Van Linden from the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependency and Don Habiger from the Juno Reentry Coalition are here to talk about reentry issues. So, gentlemen, welcome to a Juno afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
And, you know, Don, I've worked with you a little bit on some of this stuff before in my capacity as an attorney and the Success Inside and Out program, but I haven't had an update lately. So what's going on with reentry programs here in Alaska's capital city?
Excellent question, Ben. And it's been about a year, I think, since we last had an opportunity to talk about it. So a lot has happened. And one of the more important things is, in a partnership with both the Department of Corrections and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, we have implemented our case management program. So we are now connecting those coming out of Lemon Creek or one of our other 12 institutions across the state to a case manager, and that case manager then is beginning to work to connect them to the community resources. Well, Mike Van Linden is that case manager, and so I'm glad he is able to join us. And he, first I should mention, so I don't set him up for failure, that this is only a process that we're doing for a couple of weeks now, case management, maybe a month. But so it's pretty new, and Mike is learning the ropes. But Mike, you want to talk a little bit about case management?
Sure, Don. So, I am the Reentry and Recovery Support Coordinator over at the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, and what that means is that I do case management for the reentry program, where I go into Lemon Creek and meet with individuals that are medium to high risk to recidivate, and we help them to reintegrate into society. And so one of the programs that we have is a recovery coach program. The recovery coach program is both a community effort as well as a reentry effort. So we have reentry coaches going into Lemon Creek and meeting with individuals with substance use disorder. And we also have people in the community that are dealing with substance use disorder, and so we're connecting them with recovery coaches as well, because obviously recidivism, you know, you've got people on the outside that you don't want to go back to the inside, and you've got people that are on the inside that you want to be successful on the outside. So that's what we are doing. We're working on this program, and
That's great. Now, so just a recovery coach is kind of like a sponsor in a 12-step program, but not exactly the same, of course.
There are similarities, but it is definitely different because a peer support person who's doing peer support is somebody who's gone through it. They have lived experience, and so what they're doing is they are sharing their experience, and it's also it's on the same plane. You're somebody who is a peer. You're not a person of authority.
Mm-hmm. So, and a sponsor is someone who's like, I've got these 12 steps down, generally speaking, and then the person who doesn't is the one who's going to them for the sponsorship. Right. Now, these recovery coaches, they all have experience not necessarily just with substance abuse, but with being incarcerated and getting back out.
Correct.
And so that's the real nexus of what's difficult because of the societal challenges, the prejudice against people who've been incarcerated. That's something that their coach can say, hey, I've been through that, and this is how I dealt with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have so some of the recovery coaches have experience with mental health disorders as well as substance use disorders. So generally, most people incarcerated have either one of those two problems. And, otherwise, we also want to help people who don't have those problems get to the services that they need as well.
Right. Now, of course, people have heard a lot about Senate Bill 91 a few years ago, and this session there was an effort to change some of the new laws that were put in place relating to Class C felonies, particularly, I think. We won't get too much into the details of that. Has that effort to overhaul our criminal justice system and then the pendulum going back a little bit this last session, has that affected the nature of the work that you're both trying to do, or is it still too early?
Well, first of all, it's affected it quite a bit because the state as a whole has this whole justice reform issue front and center. And actually, predecessor to SB 91 a couple of years ago is SB 64, and it's been about a three-year march, if I remember the chronology. At any rate, one of the most important pieces of this is community involvement and a community reentry program. In other words, a community coming together in such a fashion that they can support instead of stigmatize folks coming. And really, the statistic is 95% of all folks coming out of incarceration end up back in your community. I didn't say that quite correctly, but I think you get the gist. And if that many are coming back, then we should find supports for them. And that's really what the Entry Coalition does.
Very good. And, another part of the Senate Bill 64, Senate Bill 91 host of changes was trying to keep people out when they were awaiting trial. Because, the pretrial detention lumped in with an incarcerated population of people who are serving a sentence has just been seen as a breeding ground for bad behaviors. And it also starts breaking down those community contacts prematurely, losing a job, losing a house, losing custody of children, all those things that may not necessarily be part of the sentence end up happening when someone's waiting. So there are a lot of moving parts in this, I know. How would you say Juneau ranks against other places in the state of Alaska putting this sort of community foot forward? Or is it possible to even compare that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to compare myself to my colleagues.
You're doing an outstanding job.
Mm. However, Juneau was one of four communities that actually piloted the community reentry project. And I have counterparts in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Mat-Su. Now, also with SB 91 and some of that money that came back to communities, I believe it was Kenai and Dillingham, and I think one other, and I can't remember what community, have startup coalitions. So any place, and here's the goal, any place that has one of our 13 institutions should be a community that has a reentry effort.
Because without one, you're basically wasting the opportunity to make it work. We pay as a society to incarcerate someone. We pay to feed them and provide health care and house them. But then we just drop the ball when they get out. It's like that's kind of a stranded investment to a certain degree.
Well, yes. The original estimation, if I remember correctly, is that we would have more folks going into prison than we had capacity for by 2017. With some of this implementation, and I was just looking at it today, I believe DOC estimates that we've prolonged that overcapacity issue out to 2023. Hopefully, with communities working like the Juneau Reentry Coalition, we can prolong that even farther.
Well, and I do remember very clearly the sort of figure that was being bandied about is we're going to have to build a new Goose Creek, and it's going to cost $100 million. And no one had $100 million lying around. You know, we barely paid for the first Goose Creek, basically. So, Mike, how many people are doing the work that you're doing here in Juneau?
So currently I have six reentry coaches. We're actually hopefully have another one too soon. So we'll have seven in total. But we're actually doing a we'll be doing another recovery coach training soon within the next couple months where we'll announce that. And then that's going to give the opportunity for more volunteers to join.
And are there people out there that we, you know, maybe don't even know that they were once incarcerated who are successful members of society who have just been kind of keeping quiet and then they'll come forward and you announce that training and that's where you draw your talent from?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're hoping so.
Very good. Well, obviously, you know, having had the experience of being inside a prison and getting out is something that most people, you know, haven't had. So that's a pretty unique life skill set to be able to share with someone. I'm going to guess there's some element of the work that does involve probation officers in the formal correctional system. How is that working out for you? Because I know that budget pressures are as high as ever on the Department of Corrections. They have really big caseloads.
Yes. As far as I've seen, there's been a there hasn't been very much support, not because that they don't want to support us, but just because that they are understaffed. And so, yeah. That's kind of, we hope to change that soon.
Right. But I think it's fair to say that you are making their jobs a little less onerous to do by providing the services you're providing to some of the people that they have to supervise, you know, on probation. So.
Yep, correct.
Excellent. So if people want to learn more about this program, Mike or Don, where would they be best advised to go and learn about upcoming meetings, training opportunities, things of that nature?
Great. Well, because of your invitation, Ben, of course, I get to announce our next community meeting, which is this Wednesday. And so Wednesday the 21st from 6 to 7:30 p.m. At the Northern Light United Church, we have our and we're entitling it the Value of Peer-Supported Community Reentry. So anybody that wants to know more about peer support, anybody that wants to be part of the solution, is more than welcome to join us. We're all inclusive in that case. And then for anything else for the Juneau Reentry Coalition, they can catch us on our website at junoreentry.com.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much for coming on a Juneau afternoon. Anything else, Mike, you want to share with our listeners?
Actually, the one thing I did want to share was that we have this program at NCADD that is called GreatBearRecovery.com. That's our website, and we do peer support, and we also do fun things for people with addictions to learn how to have fun again.
Okay, very good. All right, Mike Van Linden from NCADD and Don Habiger from the Juneau Reentry Coalition. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming on a Juneau afternoon.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
If you don't like going to the dentist, it's probably because it was a bad experience for you as a child. Times have changed. The board-certified pediatric dentist at the new Search Children's Dental Clinic will explain things in a way your child understands and provide fun distractions. Kids will actually want to go to the dentist and want to take care of their teeth throughout their lives. The new Children's Dental Clinic at Search is proud to offer pediatric dental services to all Juneau's kids. To make an appointment for your child, call 789-KIDS.
It's about 53 minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juneau afternoon, this Monday, the 19th of June. And our next and final guest today is going to be Alex Pierce. She's just getting her headphones on. Welcome to a Juneau afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I did promise listeners at the beginning of the show that we were going to give them an update on Project Playground, and you've made that true. You've prevented me from telling a fib on the air, so I'm grateful for that. And I know some money's been raised, but every time I drive by, it doesn't look like a lot of actual demolition has started. So give us an update on what's going on out there.
So demolition is scheduled to start tomorrow.
Okay.
It took some time. We needed to do some environmental testing. We had to put out the RFP for deconstruction, demolition, and we've contracted GR Cheeseman Construction to clean up the playground. So that'll be starting tomorrow with removal of the pickets. There's been a lot of discussion, at least internally at the city, with people calling in about the pickets on the fence, which you may or may not recall were a fundraising thing that was done when the playground was initially
built. People could buy a picket.
Yeah, you could buy a picket.
Right.
And so people have been asking, will our pickets be incorporated into the new playground? Can I have my picket back? Some of them were completely burned and destroyed. Others are in kind of various states of burned. Some of them are fine. So we'll be removing the legible pickets and stockpiling them at the CBJ Works Yard in the Valley. And we'll be kind of determining the condition and how to move forward with them, and we'll be putting that out to the public at a future date.
But none of those are really going to be reusable.
They may be.
Okay.
We need to move the ones that may be reusable, that are still legible, and see what kind of condition they're in. And we're working with a steering committee to come up with a plan for reconstruction and whether there'll be some sort of memorial incorporation or whether we'll just make them available to the people who maybe want them. We're just working through those details and how that's going to look right now.
Well, it's clearly a work in progress. So if there is going to be the demolition starting tomorrow, are there any logistical aspects of that people who drive by on Glacier Highway need to be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. So there will be large trucks going in and out of the area. One thing that may cause a little bit of alarm is that the crews are going to be wearing Tyvek suits and respirators. We've had an environmental consultant working with us since the date of the fire. They're going to be doing air quality monitoring on site. The site has been deemed safe for general public use, but with the crews really working down in the material and stirring it up, it's really just a safety precaution to keep the workers safe. The trucks, as they're leaving the site, will be covered, so there won't be burned material blowing out the back or anything like that. But the shelter and restroom will be closed, and the bike path, you'll be able to access it from the bus stop, which for people familiar with the area, there's a bus stop kind of up on Glacier Highway above Coat Park, kind of directly above the playground, and it has a little ADA ramp down onto the bike path, and people will be able to get onto the path that way.
Excellent. So we don't have a great deal of time left this afternoon. Is there a website where people can go and learn more about some of those particulars? And if they still want to donate to the worthy cause, how can they do that?
Absolutely. The website is www.goprojectplaygrounds.org, and they can go on there and learn all about what the steering committee is doing, where we're going, and how we're working to redesign and rebuild the playground.
And just really quickly, how is the fundraising going?
The fundraising is going great. We have raised upwards of $160,000, and right now we're just trying to work through the RFP for redesign, and then once we have a contractor in place, we'll be able to determine what improvements are going to be made and what kind of funds we're going to need to raise for those. The improvements are really safety and accessibility things that we're aware of after using the park for 10 years.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm so sorry we don't have more time, but Alex Pierce, thank you so much for being here on behalf of Project Playground. What's the website one more time?
GoProjectPlayground.org.
Very good. Thank you so much, and keep up the good work out there.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from AEL&P, reminding listeners that when less hot water is used, less water is heated and money is saved. Low-flow faucets and showerheads are easy to install and provide savings. More information at AELP.com.
And it's about 58 and a half minutes after the hour, or a minute and a half before the hour, depending on how you look at it. Thanks so much for listening to A Juneau Afternoon this Monday, the 19th of June. I'm Ben Brown. The weather forecast hasn't changed since the beginning of the hour. It's going to be kind of rainy for the rest of the week, but it's looking like by Friday it's going to be nice, and that means the concert on Friday afternoon will be in front of the new museum. Thanks again for listening to A Juneau Afternoon.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269...